Okay, House Judiciary is called to order. The time is 12:35, and it is the 4th of June. Happy Sunday, everyone. For the record, we have present Representatives Gruenberg, Cott, Guerra, Coghill, Wilson, and myself, McGuire. We do have a quorum to conduct business. Representative Anderson is on his way. We have one item on the agenda today that we will take up, and that is the issue of House Bill number 2002 regarding original jurisdiction. We have obviously folks from the administration that would like to speak to the bill, and I will go ahead and take their testimony first, and then we have Doug Wolliver from the court system who's online to answer any questions, as well as Philip Gilden, who is an attorney hired by the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee, who's available to answer questions as well. So just for the members' edification. So Jim Baldwin, and if you and Bonnie want to come up together, that's fine. That way you can coordinate your testimony. Welcome to House Judiciary.
Thank you.
Of anywhere else you'd rather be spending your Sunday?
What's salmon are biting?
Be donuts.
Sorry about that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With me is Bonnie Harris from the Attorney General's Office. My name is Jim Baldwin, and I'm a counsel to the Attorney General's Office. We're here today to testify on House Bill 2002, which was submitted by the governor. This bill is intended to provide original jurisdiction in the Alaska Supreme Court to review legal challenges to the Alaska Stranded Gas Development Act fiscal contract. It ties in with some agreements that were made and appear in the Stranded Gas contract. In Article 27.2, where the parties have agreed that under the normal terms of the contract, there can be a suspension of obligations in the face of a legal challenge to the underlying authority for the contract. But under that provision, there would be no right to suspend for a period of 15 months. So that we can advance planning of the project. That 15-month period was determined, perhaps not very scientifically, but as best we could, to determine how long it would take to get an expedited process through the courts to deal with the major issues involved with the stranded gas. So what we did is we came up with this approach, which would provide for, as I said, original jurisdiction in the Supreme Court to deal with these issues, and also provided a limited statute of limitations period for bringing these kinds of actions, that period being 60 days. And there was a period in existing law which was 120 days. So what this bill would do would be, as I said, original jurisdiction with a limited statute of limitation period for bringing these claims of 60 days.
Madam Chair.
Representative Guerra.
You said in the existing statute there are rules, there was a 120-day rule. Is there another rule on original jurisdiction in the Supreme Court somewhere? Or where is the 120-day rule in existing law?
It's in the 440 section that we're amending.
Oh, in the Stranded Gas Act?
Yes.
Okay.
Sorry if I didn't make my
The Stranded Gas Act already has original jurisdiction in it?
No, it does not. We would be adding that.
So the 120-day rule, if it in the law now, if it doesn't apply to original jurisdiction, I thought you meant that there's a 120-day rule for original jurisdiction that we have to change.
No, there's a 120-day limitation period for bringing
Got it.
Bringing an action.
Okay.
We would change that to original jurisdiction in the Supreme Court and then shorten that limitation period. Authority for doing this, we believe, is in Article 4, Section 1, which says that the legislature may establish the jurisdiction of the courts. We believe this is a jurisdictional statute as well as a limitation period statute, and limitation periods are for suits against the state or within the legislature's lawmaking power as well. So on that basis, that being the underlying rationale for our bill, we'll take questions.
Representative Gruenberg.
Yeah. Your interpretation of Section 1 of Article 4, the second sentence, quote, the jurisdiction of courts, plural, shall be prescribed by law, when they mention the Supreme Court by name in the first sentence, would seem to be a very strong interpretation. Is there any other statute or rule or common law in this state that gives the Supreme Court original jurisdiction in any other case? Except, well, no, because even in bar things that's in a, well, I guess that would be considered original jurisdiction of a bar discipline.
I'm aware of one, and I believe Mr. Wolliver, when he testifies, can also comment on this. The one provision that I'm aware of is in recount appeals, where there is by statute specified original jurisdiction for the court. Also, in I believe it's Rule 404, the court has
Rule 404.
Yes, Appellate Rule 404. The court has stated that it can exercise original jurisdiction in aid of its appellate jurisdiction. Those are the, and I believe Mr. Wolver testified that there were other occasions. There's one other occasion which I think is no longer in the statutes, where original jurisdiction was provided. Did I get the number right?
Here. Yeah, it's called original application.
Yeah,
here,
right.
You want to take it?
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Questions for Mr.
Wolver? I think he's still, I don't know if he's finished.
Do you have anything further?
No, I have nothing further. I'm willing to take questions.
Oh, could I have that back? Sure. I thought you wanted a quote from
that. So, there are rules of appellate procedure around the table, but it's 404.
There are rules around the table?
This is actually...
I probably just keep mine here all the time. Tom, yeah. At one point, I bought you all one.
Mine's upstairs.
Okay. So it's Rule 404 governing original applications.
Appellate Rule 404?
Yes. That's correct. Okay, so further questions for...
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative
Gruenberg. In 404A1, it seems to envision another circumstance. An original application for relief may be filed with the appellate court or a judge or justice thereof in any matter within its jurisdiction whenever relief is not available from any other court and cannot be obtained through the process of appeal, petition for review, or petition for hearing. Grant of the application is not a matter of right, but of sound discretion, sparingly exercised.
Representative Kira.
I would just state for the outset that, I know the intention is to try and find a quick way to get these cases resolved, and I agree with that. But by having original jurisdiction in the Supreme Court to five justices that haven't either ever done a trial or haven't done one in 10 or 20 years, with no court staff to do that, I think the quicker way, if you would consider it, would be to have an expedited case at the trial court and an expedited appeal to the Supreme Court. I know I'm not going to have the ability to change that myself. I think your procedure is going to end up being slower just at the outset. My first question is this. Obviously this is going to have to be some sort of combination of a trial and an appeal decision, right? I mean, you're going to have to be able to get documents. A party challenging this contract is going to have to get documents, some information, probably some depositions, probably do some trial presentation before the Supreme Court. I've looked through here. I don't see any procedures in the Supreme Court to accommodate something like that. The Supreme Court usually, one party shows up, they write a 50-page document, they argue the 50-page document for an hour before the Supreme Court, the other party makes their argument, and that's it. But there's no procedure in the Supreme Court for people to have access to evidence, access to information. Are there procedures?
Madam Chair, The way we perceive this is unfolding, although, as you know, in the uncertainty of litigation and the brilliance of the attorneys that are involved in that litigation makes for many variables that are hard to anticipate. It's our belief that, and what we intend, is that this be a procedure that's available for dealing with basically questions of constitutional law or questions of law, in which case the Supreme Court in many cases has proclaimed that it's the final arbiter of questions of law, and it seems like the Superior Court is sometimes like a speed bump in the way towards that ultimate decision making. And so for those kind of cases, I think there will be the Supreme Court is well endowed to deal with those cases. But it is possible that there could be factual disputes that could be brought forward in the way the cases are pled or the issues are identified by the parties. In that instance, the court, I believe, and just it's just my assumption, and it could be wrong, is that the court would appoint a master.
A master to do the trial, or at the trial, the discovery procedures, that sort of stuff?
Yes.
Is there authority in the rules for that, though?
Well, the court would probably make a rule, or the master would establish a procedure for the parties. I've seen that happen, where the master, you know, there are depositions. There's almost like a full trial proceeding before the master.
Tell me if you think I'm interrupting. I'm just trying to speed this along. Just look at me sideways or something. I just don't see the rules that allow that to automatically happen. And if you're going to say the Supreme Court shall adopt rules, again, that's one of the reasons why I'm worried that this is going to take longer than just an expedited trial and appeal process. Because when the Supreme Court adopts rules, it takes time. They have to do notice provisions, publication provisions. So if you're going to set a process and say the Supreme Court has no rules for conducting a trial, no rules for conducting discovery, no rules for processing evidence, you shall adopt this by rule, and then we have to wait for the Supreme Court to adopt rules. Have you thought about whether that is going to cause you delay?
Well, Madam Chair, what we've thought about is looking at the Judicial Council statistics for the length of time it takes for civil actions to move through the courts. Those statistics basically say that if you've got a case that involves more than $15,000 at risk, you're looking at least a year to get it through the Superior Court. That's just the fact of it. But if you've got a case like this where you've got billions of dollars at stake, we could be involved for years at the lower court level without any sign of relief. And we have here a situation where the parties have agreed to perform, notwithstanding judicial challenges, and spend over $100 million. So our intent here is to try to advance the process. And it may be effective, or it may fall into the kinds of pitfalls you're describing. But we think this is probably the most effective and active thing we can do to advance that cause.
I'm looking for a memo right now. That's why I'm frantic over here, and hopefully I'll get it and I'll distribute it to the committee that I had Jack Chenoweth prepare for me on the Trans-Alaska Pipeline original jurisdiction issue and timeline. Have you, I would assume, in preparing this legislation, you thought about that, considering that that's the only other mega project with similar dollar amounts involved, similar time constraints, and similar concerns of challenges. And if you do, if you have any comments regarding that, how that played out, and what considerations you looked at there.
Well, that was in the federal system, I believe. Yes, and I can't recount for you the timeline that occurred there, but it was effective to move the claims through the court system, the federal court system, and was part of the motivation for us trying to proceed on the state level that way. And we were encouraged by the comments that we heard on the Senate side from the court system, indicating that, you know, they would, to the extent they can, give comity to such a statute coming from the legislature, conferring that kind of jurisdiction.
We do have Doug Wolver on the line, and Doug, I would appreciate at this point you weighing in. You've heard the discussion going forward, and I'd appreciate any comments you have on behalf of the court system.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But for the record, Doug Wolver, administrative attorney for the Alaska court system. As Mr. Baldwin mentioned, I'm aware of also two statutes that have one current statute that confers original jurisdiction on the Supreme Court, and that's, I think he mentioned, the challenges to election recounts. And there was another statute also related to elections that's no longer on the books. I'm aware of five reported opinions from those two statutes. In three of those cases, the Supreme Court resolved the issues without the appointment of a special master. And in two of those instances, the court did appoint a special master. And typically, the distinction between the two types of cases is whether, as Representative Guerra has mentioned, whether there are depositions and discovery, taking of evidence, challenges to evidence, the types of things that would happen in a trial. So what has happened in the past in the Alaska Supreme Court, when a special master has been appointed in cases of original jurisdiction, the court simply appoints a Superior Court judge to serve as special master. And then it's very much like a Superior Court trial. In terms of the, and I should also state this, my typical testimony before the committee, the court is neutral on this bill. We neither support it nor oppose it. The timeline issue, as also Mr. Baldwin mentioned, the court in the past, there are some statutes that impose timelines. Some of you have been around for a while may know there are constitutional restrictions on the legislature's authority to impose timelines on how long judges have to resolve issues. Nevertheless, when timelines are imposed, the court has and continues to work very hard to meet those timelines. Constitutionally required to or not, the court has always made every effort to meet them. In this case, with or without timelines, of course, the court is very much aware of the importance of these cases and would give them appropriate level of priority. But other than that, I'm ready to take any other questions you might have.
Representative Guerra.
Thanks. Thanks, Doug. Let me just ask my basic questions just to make sure. So I don't know what the statute reads about original jurisdiction and the Supreme Court's ability to conduct a trial and use a master in the elections arena. But this bill, the way it's written, it says nothing about granting the Supreme Court additional powers to do a trial, appoint a master. If we have no language on that, will the Supreme Court still have the authority to appoint a master and conduct a trial and do discovery procedures and stuff without any language in this bill?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, neither the current statute nor the earlier one that I'm aware of had language regarding the appointment of a special master. It simply confers on the Supreme Court original jurisdiction, and then the court just exercises its inherent authority to conduct its proceedings to appoint a master if it feels that that's the appropriate way to go with that particular case.
Okay. Thank you. So I mean, just so I'm 100% clear, the Supreme Court will have the authority to conduct some sort of trial and discovery procedure the way this bill is written?
To the chair, Representative Guerra, yes.
Okay. Then that solves one of my concerns. Mr. Baldwin said the Supreme Court is anticipated to adopt rules to implement some of this stuff. If we leave it open so that they would do this by a rulemaking procedure, how long would that take, given the rules, the requirement of notice and that sort of stuff when the Supreme Court adopts a rule?
Representative Guerra, I'm not sure the court would adopt rules. They may, though. It is possible that they would if this looked like it was going to be a fairly large body of cases. the rulemaking process varies in terms of length of time. You know, I'm at home today. I don't have a lot of resources available to check on this. The court can expedite the rulemaking process if it needs to, but I'm afraid I'm not prepared to give an estimate, and I just don't know how long that process, if the court were to take that route, how long that process would go on. I do know that they can expedite things, but I'm afraid I can't give you a very definitive answer.
I'll just leave that to you and the Attorney General's office, but it seems that if we're trying to do things in an expedited manner, it might be that we will want the court to do this by order rather than by this by a cumbersome rulemaking process if that takes too long. I'll just leave that to you guys. I have one other question that really concerns me.
Madam Chair.
Representative Gruenberg?
May I follow through on this point, please? Mr. Woolover, we happen to have copies of the appellate rules in front of us, and I'd refer the members to rules 5, Appellate Rule 520 and Appellate Rule 521, which is in the book at page 713 and following. And those generally allow the court to relax or dispense with the other rules in the interests of justice. And it's very similar to civil rules that say the same thing in criminal rules. And, for example, I'd refer you to a case on page 715, right-hand column, about halfway down, which allowed the court to treat an action for injunctive relief against an administrative agency as an appeal and allow it, even though the rules didn't specifically provide for that. I personally was involved in one of those election cases, Cisna versus Stout, when the court sat en banc and didn't appoint a special master in an election recount, and they handled it easily. They did it by an order. They don't have to do a rule. I was on the Appellate Rules Committee for like 5 years, and they can promulgate rules not that fast, but in a case of this type, which would be a one-of-a-kind case, they'd come out with a comprehensive order. They wouldn't have to go through the rulemaking procedure. And Mr. Woolover, I hope that helps a little bit.
Yes, I guess I see your name, Representative Gruenberg, here on the council in that case. I have the Stout case here.
And Shalon is handing out copies of the two work orders that were prepared regarding judicial review in the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. And yes, it was federal, but I just wanted folks to see that there was a similar thought process at that time. Representative Gary, you had one other question.
Yeah, so I'm comforted on that first part. So the Supreme Court has the authority to conduct a trial and do discovery and things like that. My other concern is this. I want there to be a level playing field between those who are defending the oil company and state position and those who want to challenge. And I'm quite confident that right now, on the oil company side, there are people already preparing their defense to this case. So they're going to have a maybe 6 month to year lead time in putting their case together, and they've got access to a lot of information. When the state signs this contract, if that happens, that's when a citizen shows up to challenge. And it may be a very well-funded citizen, it may not be, but they won't have started their work on this case. So what can you do to comfort me that a citizen is going to have, under these sort of non-specific rules that we have before us, there are no rules before us, can you comfort me that a citizen is going to have adequate time to get up to speed and get the evidence so that they at some point get on an even playing field with the oil companies who've been working on this for at least probably a year before the citizen starts? Doug, that's to you.
I thought it was for Jim.
He was busy reading the paper, enjoying his Sunday.
I'm sorry, Representative Gara. The court doesn't take a position on the kind of the statute of limitations issues here. I imagine that the administration will have a position on that. Legislature sets these statutes, and the court doesn't weigh in one way or another on whether you've allowed adequate time or not.
I didn't. I didn't mean the statute of limitations issue. That's part of it, and we can address that here. What I really meant was, let's say somebody files within statute of limitations period. So January 1st, 2007, this contract is signed. You've got, you know, BP's had its attorneys working on this for a year and a half. They've got their ducks in a row. A citizen hires an attorney, and they need to prepare their case. There's no rules in this bill that say, that talk about the amount of time we're going to let the person challenging this contract to prepare their case, to get the evidence to determine whether or not the gas was stranded, to that sort of stuff. So do we need to add any rules of fair play into this bill so that they have time to prepare their case, or should we just feel comfortable that the Supreme Court will deal with that without any directive on our part?
Okay, I think I understand the question better now. Sorry. Representative Guerra, typically, whatever the statute of limitations are in other statutes as well, where I don't believe we have rules about how long, let me rephrase this. Courts grant continuances all the time, as you're aware, to make sure that parties aren't forced to litigate prior to the time they are ready. We don't typically have legislative directions in that regard. It is left up to the discretion of the judge to manage the case as he or she thinks is most appropriate. You could always put some in. I'm not quite sure what they would look like, though. At least typically, those decisions are left up to just the general case management decisions that the judge makes.
And I just want to note, he's gone already.
He's gone.
Representative Gruenberg.
Yes, if I may, from my experience, usually discovery rules and briefing rules and stuff like that are found exclusively in the rules of court. I don't recall any statutes that deal with that, and Mr. Williver, correct me if I'm wrong, but in Cisna versus Stout, I recall getting some extensions of time on briefing issues and things like that, and I think the other sides did too. There were several other parties to that. And the court was very reasonable in allowing that to occur, and they relaxed the normal appellate rules where you have to bind your briefs and stuff like that. Here we just submitted it on memoranda and things, and so if that's of any help, they were very reasonable.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Guerra?
This is going to be fantastically more complex than an election recount.
Of course.
Let me ask you this, Doug. I have an amendment prepared, but I don't know if it helps things any, which would say the Supreme Court shall give the parties adequate time to prepare and present their case. I assume that's probably implied and the court would do that anyway, but do we need to put something like that into the bill, or should we be comfortable in assuming that the court is going to do that on its own? I guess that's the question.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, that type of language I'm sure doesn't hurt. I guess I have a fair bit of faith that the court will do the right thing. Regardless, the Supreme Court, as you probably know, is deliberative, sometimes considered deliberative to a fault. They don't like to rush cases, but that kind of language I'm sure doesn't hurt at all.
Does it help? Is it necessary?
Madam Chairman, I don't believe that it's necessary.
Okay. Further questions for Mr. Williver so I can let him go and enjoy his afternoon? Or do members have a preference about him remaining online?
Madam Chair, Mr. Williver, are you going to have a cell phone handy?
Actually, I would prefer to just stay online and listen anyway, Chair. Thanks for considering me, though.
Okay. And, Doug, this is Tom Anderson. I'd ask that you stay online the entire day.
Just like yesterday. Okay.
That's right.
If you have any amendments on the oil tax bill, get them to us by 2.
Okay.
So,
Madam Chair.
Representative Groom.
Mr. Williver, since you're on the phone here, have you had a chance to review House Bill 2002? And the Judiciary CS to Senate Bill 2002?
Yes, Representative Gruenberger has.
Does the court system have any suggested amendments?
No, we do not.
Thank you.
Okay, so why don't we go ahead? Is there anybody in the audience that wishes to testify on House Bill 2002? Is there anybody else online? Okay, so public testimony itself is closed, and that brings the bill back before us. Representative Gruenberg.
I don't know. Had Mr. Baldwin, had you finished your testimony?
Well, we were just ready to take questions, and we've done that. So if there's, we'll be available.
Well, wait a minute. I had some questions.
Okay.
Jeez. Come on back, Bonnie.
They'll be available as we. What I'd like to do is start working through the bill. So because I think the bulk of our questions and testimony will surround themselves, for example, in the Coghill Amendment is probably the big part of the discussion. So a thought would be, if you wanted, any generalized questions, go ahead and answer.
No, let's just, as long as they can be here so that we can ask them questions as we go along.
So how do we want to work our way? Who wants to offer which amendment first?
Mr. Coghill, Representative Coghill, do his.
Representative Coghill.
I don't know that my name's actually on it, but I'd like to have the amendment that starts off with delete page line 1, line 8 through page 2, line 2. Amendment number 1.
Okay. I'm going to go ahead and move that.
I'll move the amendment, please.
Is there an objection to amendment number 1? There's an objection noted. So speaking to, do you want to speak to your objection, or how about you outline your amendment first, and then we'll let Representative Cott respond.
This amendment begins by mirroring pretty much what passed through the other body. Since we're going to be meeting up with them, probably for the execution, it takes it up to 120 days from the 60 days, and it talks about, if you look on line 6, an action challenging final agency decision under 4382-430C and the constitutionality of it. I think that what that does, takes a final agency decision action challengeable at the end of the process. So I think that's what they were heading for doing. It brings us to the original jurisdiction that we've been talking about under lines 4 and 5, and deals with a final agency decision under the Stranded Gas Act, and allows for 120 days after the date of the contract was executed to bring the action. So those are the three major parts. I know the department wants 60 days. I think we can debate that, but at this point.
One thought I had, Representative Coghill, just for you to consider in the Gruenbergian style, would be to consider whether or not you want to, well, we can have the discussion, but if the sticking point becomes the number of days, you may want to consider bifurcating your amendment. I don't really see a natural place, but there are sort of three separate concepts contained in it. But why don't we go ahead and have Representative Cott respond? He's first in the queue here, and then move our way through. And if that becomes a point, I'm just saying be prepared to follow suit with that. Representative Cott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's probably not a bad idea. Unfortunately, I'm not as comfortable with my colleague across from me on what the other body does. I've never been one to follow them precisely or exactly through their process. I'm sure I am concerned over the 120 days period. I think that's way too long to file some action of challenge. I think under the Trans-Alaska Pipeline Authorization process, under federal law, we allowed for 60 days. And I would be happy to maybe split the baby with Representative Coghill and suggest 45 days.
You mean 90?
I said 45.
Goodness, <yeah. laughs> right about around the toe knuckle.
And maybe, Madam Chair, or maybe Mr. Baldwin or Bonnie, the section in this amendment on lines 14 dealing with person, can you comment on whether that should be in here? It appears to me that it would probably be a good part of this amendment to have that included.
Before they respond, Madam Chair, there has been an amendment proposed that would say on line 6, no action challenging a final agency. So you take the person out and you would take the need for the definition starting from line 12, a person through the remainder of that amendment out. So there's a suggested amendment to the amendment. I was going to go ahead and float that out, but I wanted to bring the amendment.
Okay, so there's an amendment being offered to Coghill's Amendment 1 by Representative Gruenberg.
May I?
Yes.
I'd like to take as an amendment to Amendment 1, and let's call this thing here that says page 1, line 10, following chapter. Can we call that Amendment Number 1 to Amendment 1?
Yeah. Okay, is there an objection to...
Wait a second. I'm going to change this a bit.
Okay.
This is just an amendment to an amendment.
Amendment to your amendment.
Yeah. Okay. Now, as part of this and conforming, I want to eliminate...
Representative Gruenberg, might I suggest that you simply offer the amendment to the amendment and you do it conceptually? I think we all understand the point that the goal is to eliminate reference to a person, and we can see how it's contained here. If you just did a conceptual amendment to the amendment and allowed the drafters to...
Yeah, let me tell you what the conceptual amendment...
You can do a second-degree amendment.
No, no. This is part of my amendment.
Okay.
That as part of this amendment number 1 will also be to delete everything starting on line 12 of amendment 1, starting with a person in AS 4882 to the end of that. So that will be part of Amendment 1 to Amendment 1. It will be to delete, I'm adding in by hand, delete all language starting with line 12, quote, a person. So that is also part of my Amendment 1 to Amendment 1. It just conforms.
And B, and delete subsection B.
And B, yes, the rest of the bill, all language in Amendment 1.
Okay.
And I offer that as Amendment 1 to Amendment 1.
Okay, so the amendment to Amendment Number 1, deleting the requirement that it's a person and simply stating the action may be brought, and then conforming with that, deleting the definition of a person. Is there any objection to Amendment 1 to Amendment 1?
Objection.
Representative Wilson.
I don't think it quite, maybe I've got this wrong, but it doesn't look like to me that quite fits. It should be page 1, line 12.
No, it's an amendment to the amendment.
Yeah.
Representative Wilson, he's amending.
Yeah, but it says line 10, see? And it's
no, he abandoned his original idea of using this and simply went with the concept of it.
It's line 12.
Yeah.
So is there an objection to the amendment to the amendment? Hearing none, the amendment to the amendment carries. That brings Amendment 1 as amended back before us for further discussion. I'd like to give the department an opportunity to respond to the amendment.
Madam Chair, we're in favor of this amendment. As amended, I guess that we're talking about the amendment as it's been amended by the by Representative Gruenberg. We think that what it does is it removes any ambiguity about what would be the definition of person.
Mr. Baldwin, let me be clear. I don't wish to have department testimony on the action we just took, rather on the pending action. So we've already made the decision to eliminate the reference to person. Now I'm asking the department's views the amendment as amended, which really contains, as I see it, two major parts. It has to do with the person bringing an action challenging the final agency decision, and it pertains to 120-day challenge as opposed to 60.
Right.
So sorry if I wasn't clear.
Thank you for reorienting
okay.
me.
Okay.
Behind the action here. We don't favor or don't support the body of the amendment for a number of reasons. First, the 120 days, which I think we stated earlier, our original position was 60 days. The reason for that, I think, is very simple. The Attorney General issued his opinion on or about May 10th. It's out there. We've set out the rationale for our constitutional construction openly and publicly. It's a part of the fiscal interest finding. As far as people without substantial means, notice has been given for a substantial period of time of what the state's legal position is. And so I think that 60 days really should be considered longer in your minds because of that. The provision here about being able to bring an action challenging a final agency decision is problematic for us. If you recall back during the regular session, we had proposed some changes to the Stranded Gas Act that affects this issue. It was primarily heard in the Senate, but I think it was considered over here as well. This involves a question in the statutes where it's provided in the Stranded Gas Act that a finding, the final finding, constitutes final agency action. And we believe that that's not a correct view of what's happening under the Stranded Gas Act. What's really final agency action is going to be when the governor, after the legislature authorizes the contract and the governor signs it, that's going to be the final agency action that becomes appealable here, and that the Stranded Gas Act is mistaken in characterizing the issuance of the final fiscal interest finding. We weren't successful in getting that legislation through, so that particular issue is out there. And our view is that when the legislature acts on, when it does act on the, and authorize the governor to sign the fiscal contract, that the issues of final agency action are all consumed by that action and are really not a justiciable controversy or not something that can be litigated within a court and is made in the legal parlance moot by the legislature's action. And so by setting out here in as it does in your amendment, you're preserving that right of action, or you're holding forth the possibility that right of action still exists. And so we have a problem with that because we think it does not exist. That's our underlying legal position, because of the intervening legislative consideration of the matter, the fiscal interest finding, and the permanent finding, the final finding, and the preliminary finding are all exercises of discretion by the commissioner, which serve as a recommendation to the legislature. And when the legislature takes it up and considers it, it becomes subsumed in the legislature's lawmaking power. So we think it has the possibility of adding or creating in the minds of people that there is a cause of action here and that it is somehow preserved, but in reality it is not, or it's of highly questionable validity.
Representative Coghill.
So maybe help me understand this. You're saying that the action of the legislature should constitute the final determination?
The the legislature's consideration leads to the final agency determination, which is the legislature will tell the governor he can sign the final contract. When the governor signs the final contract, that's when it's final. That's when the case is ripe for adjudication and not for.
So, Madam Chair, if I may.
Yes, Representative Coghill.
There comes a time, though, when we've heard it, the case made that until we actually have a final draft, that the challenge is premature. And so until the legislature is given authority under the conditions that we've got under the Stranded Gas Act, we don't have a final determination which can be challenged. And then it appears then that what you're saying is you don't want to challenge after the legislature has determined that they have accepted the findings of the commissioner.
What I'm saying is I think that it's a questionable validity, that it's a challenge that it's a challenge to a finding or a determination of the commissioner, which has become subsumed within the legislature's lawmaking power, and is really not a controversy which we think a court could adjudicate.
That, Madam Chair, if I might.
Yes, please do.
I need to understand this very well. You're saying the fact that the legislature has accepted the findings of the administration under these conditions, that it that precludes a challenge to those findings?
What I'm saying is that the legislature's power to consider this matter is based on its constitutional power to make law. And when it takes these matters up and considers them, it considers it presumably independently, that what the legislature, what the governor or the commissioner recommends to the legislature is like, in any instance, like a bill that we send to the legislature. That these, the legislature takes a look at our bills, and I can't count on my fingers how many times our bills have gone through that have been unchanged. I don't think it's ever happened. Maybe it's happened. I can't tally up once when that's happened. But the legislature always seems to exercise its independent judgment on these matters, and I presume it will do that for the Stranded Gas Fiscal Agreement contract. And that when the legislature takes it up and authorizes it, any kind of fighting that's going to go over about the fiscal interest finding should be over with, because the legislature's looked at it, considered it. Those fights go on here as a lawmaking matter. That's where it's appropriate to go on, and not in the courts. That's what we're saying. And I think the courts would look at this, we hope the courts would look at this and say it's not something that's justiciable, that it's something that was considered by the legislature within its lawmaking powers, and we're not going to get involved in that, because it involves considerations which are not really appropriate for judicial resolution. That's our legal position.
Just jumping in really quickly, isn't the vote on the contract, though, isn't it an up or down vote? So where is this deliberation and this modification coming in that you're discussing? I guess that's I'm missing that part.
There hasn't been any deliberation or modification going on. I don't know what I've been doing for the last 3 days.
Okay. But that's what I want to understand. So you're suggesting that this what we're doing now is the...
Yes. I mean, the legislature takes the matter up and is considering it thoroughly, from my observation, and is examining every molecule of the of what we've put before them and before you, and that deliberation.
I'm just trying to understand your tracking, because on the contract itself, the way the Stranded Gas Act envisions the process is that it will be presented to the legislature in the form of an ultimatum. And so there really isn't that, I just wanted to be clear on the record, that there really isn't that deliberative amending process that you're talking about.
Madam Chair.
Representative Coghill and then Wilson.
I think that was kind of where I was leading to. because the authority that comes through the next bill that we'll see, which is going to be the amendments to the Stranded Gas Act, give you authority to do some of the things that have already gone on late in the process as it is. But the negotiation of the fiscal interest findings, the issues that come along the main contract, I hear frequently, you give us the authority and we'll be able to deliver you a finalized contract. And we won't. We haven't seen the LLCs, and we haven't seen some of the big pieces yet. And so we're going to be at the end of the process saying yay or nay. Certainly we'll scrutinize it again should it come back this way. But I think as far as anybody who wants to challenge it, I want to know when is it not appropriate to challenge the final action of the administration? Is it because the legislature has made an up or down vote, or is it during this discovery process before we get the contract finalized? And so those are the kind of things I'm trying to track, because to me, if somebody really does want to challenge it on its merit, the day that they see the finalized version is really when they should do that, not when it's in the incubation stage. And right now we're truly in the incubation stage, I think.
Do you have a response, and then Representative Wilson?
Well, the sort of the concept of justiciability deals with whether a controversy is ripe, and that is usually articulated as whether or not you have something that's final. And in our view, you don't have anything that's final until the governor signs it. And so that's, I think, the spirit of the amendment, which we support, and is the spirit of our bill as well, that we're looking towards counting from the period of execution of the contract as being when appeal rights run. The problem we were having with the Stranded Gas Act during the regular session is that it could be construed that there would be a final action when the preliminary, or when the final fiscal interest finding was presented to the legislature, which kicks off the consideration of the whether or not the authorization bill process, which is still ahead of you. And we didn't want that to intervene to prevent the legislature from being able to consider the contract. And we were working on that, and so that's the finality issue that we described, and we felt, and we still believe that these arguments of just non-justiciability apply here, and would give us the ability to withstand those kinds of challenges. But to have it embodied here as you have in this amendment that you've proposed, we think would give more potential credence to that kind of a cause of action. And that's why we oppose it.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jim, here's what I think I hear you saying. We will take the contract and go through it, you know, every little nook and cranny of it. And even if we have an up or down vote on that, we may say we can't accept this clause, so we're going to vote it down. But that may mean that then the governor or whoever has the choice of saying, okay, they said no, but if we change this clause, they will okay it. So we may vote it down, and he may make some changes, and then we may look at it again. And so until that dialogue and that communication takes place, the final thing does not happen until it's signed. And then and only then is when we're going to be, it's done, and then we know what the final is. And I guess I'm asking you, if line six and seven were deleted, Would that handle it then?
And you're referring to lines 6 and 7 of the amendment?
Of the amendment, yeah.
Just to be clear.
Well, I'm not so clear, Madam Chair, whether you need to delete the notwithstanding any other provision of law. That might go with other things here. I'd have to think about that. But,
so then
but yes.
If we deleted in the middle of 6, a person may not bring an action challenging the final agency decision of the Commissioner of Revenue made under blah, blah, blah. So if that much was taken out, then we could proceed back and forth until we came up with something final. And we made, the legislature could indeed turn it down a couple times before we okayed it.
Well, this
in the alternative, too, just on that point, the House version does that.
Yes, it what this does is it I mean, left alone, it would do that. Okay. What we're saying is any mention of it dignifies it, and that's the problem that we have with it.
So just to be clear, Mr. Baldwin, the House version you prefer because it doesn't reference the challenge of the final agency decision and because it keeps 60 days.
That's right.
Okay. All right. Okay. Representative Gruenberg and then Garrow.
I'd like to just follow up on Representative Wilson's question. There are two different issues, and they're a little bit getting confused. One is when you have to file your lawsuit challenging the constitutionality, and that is 120 days after the last party signs the contract, according to the amendment. The second is whether you can challenge the commissioner's factual findings. As he said, whether those are, quote, justiciable, which means whether a court has the authority to hold that those are unconstitutional or may just be clearly erroneous, some standard of that type. And what Mr. Baldwin was talking about was that issue, not the time issue. You understand that?
Representative Wilson.
Yeah.
I mean, it would be silly for any lawsuit to happen until it was final because it might get changed.
Yeah, but he's talking about a different issue. It's not a question of when something is final. It's a question of whether the court can consider it at all. And he's saying, correct me if I'm wrong, Jim, but he is saying that that's a legislative determination and therefore not judicially reviewable. Am I understanding you
right? Just on that point, I think, though, that you are saying that once the contract is signed into law by the governor, I mean, once he has signed that contract, I don't want to say into law, but once he has signed that contract, that at that point, it is ripe.
Yes.
So it's not that there is no opportunity to challenge ever. I don't think that that's the administration's position, that the public or anyone else wouldn't have the opportunity to challenge the contract.
But it's the question of what it is. And what he is saying is that's a legislative determination, not an agency determination. Agency decisions are reviewable for things like clear error or abuse of discretion. If it's a legislative determination, that is not reviewable generally, unless it's unconstitutional. It's a totally higher standard, and it is much different than the review of an agency decision. And the administration, and that's really key, it almost insulates the commissioner's finding from judicial review.
Well,
it
just
almost takes away the judge's powers to do that.
Just to be clear, though, this is not something that's out of the ordinary, and that's why I wanted people to see the memos on the Trans-Alaska Pipeline Authorization, because in that legislation, the concept was twofold. It was to expedite the period of time in which claims would be made to 60 days so that there would be certainty in any event given for all the reasons we've discussed. But the second prong was the notion that any actions would be denied unless they were pertaining to rights under the Constitution of the United States or that the action was beyond the scope of authority conferred by the title. So just so that everyone is clear, that's accurate, Representative Gruenberg, that in pushing that point of ripeness and the place where you can challenge it to the signing of the contract, you are changing the scope of what it is you can challenge because it's not an agency decision, but that is in keeping with the one other mega project that we know of in Alaska. So it's a policy call.
Well,
Representative Gruenberg.
Okay, let's look at the Chenoweth Memorandum, which is only a little over a page. And the main thing is it sets forth the text of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline legislation. And looking in the italics, it's clear, and I'm almost all the way down, claims will deny rights under the Constitution. And under the K&L Distributors versus Murkowski, the courts always retain jurisdiction over constitutional issues.
Right.
But the second phrase, and that the action is beyond the scope of authority conferred by this title, that is absolutely key. And there's no similar language in the state law that we're considering.
Okay. Well, then that's something that we could consider in the form of an amendment as well.
I think that's really key. And Mr. Baldwin, I would ask you and anybody else what that means. And I should know because I was Stevens LA when this was done. But I don't remember. I think that it means that, as I recall, that the action taken by the federal officials was illegal, but it was they exceeded the scope of their authority. And at the very least, that kind of a thing, and I'm only raising that, Madam Chair and Mr. Baldwin, because if we are going to adopt the Wilson thought here, I'm not going to call it a proposal, but your idea of excising that, you may be divesting the court of other authorities it had even under NEPA, under the Trans-Alaska Pipeline Act. And I just don't know the scope of that.
Any comment to that, Mr. Baldwin?
You know, I don't. It's kind of hit me cold here.
You should have a little research done on that because I don't know either.
I think that what it's dealing with is whether or not it exceeds the authority granted in the law. So in comparison here, it'd be or whether, I think in our bill, what we said was, or the enforceability of a contract developed under this chapter.
It is, Madam Chair, if I may dialogue for a minute. It's different because under the Stranded Gas Act, as you, the administration, interpreted, it gets the legislature into the administrative process and makes the legislature almost a quasi-agency. And under the Trans-Alaska Pipeline Act, there was nothing making Congress part of the process like that. It's totally different. And that's the key legal distinction. This is not an easy issue.
Okay.
We're no caucus. It will be on the floor at 2, so...
No caucus. Okay, so in light of that, then we'll continue until 2. One thing I did want to point out, there's a very expensive consultant on the line that I'd like, if folks have, he is available to answer questions. If people have questions, why don't we go ahead and ask them of him now so that we can get him off the clock. Does anyone have any questions? Representative
Garrett? Who's online?
It's Philip Gildon.
Mr. Gildon, do you have a copy of the amendment that, or a copy of the Senate committee version of the bill that we're trying to make our House bill look like with that extra sentence that Mr. Baldwin's concerned about?
Yeah, I have a copy of the committee substitute for the Senate bill.
Yeah. Okay. So do you have any comments on the desirability of leaving in the provision that also allows people to challenge a final agency decision of the Commissioner of Revenue made under 4382-430C or the administration's proposal to delete that?
I would have one comment, and it's not to the substantive question that has been discussed over the last 5-10 minutes as to whether or not the legislative action would preclude that. But the point I would want to make is that as this section is written, this section where that clause is in place is a statute of limitations provision, which means that if you take out the provision that you're talking about, then you may put yourself in a technical position of removing a challenge that someone could make to an agency action from the statute of limitations, which I assume is not the intent or desire of anyone in the proceeding, whichever side you go on that. So my major concern with removing that section from here is that by removing it, you don't keep someone from bringing a challenge of an agency action, even if the administration's position could be correct that it's ultimately a losing proposition. But if you take it out of here, or you don't otherwise make provision for such a challenge to fall within the statute of limitations, then you run the risk of having such a challenge fall outside the statute of limitations that can be brought any time in the next 3-4 years. So I would just caution that by removing it for the purpose of a substantive purpose, you might run afoul of a technical position that someone can then fall outside your statute of limitations and bringing such a challenge.
Mr. Gilden, that's a point I hadn't thought about. So I suppose you could actually then leave that issue to be decided accidentally in Superior Court under a 2 or 3 or 6 year statute of limitations, which I don't think is anybody's intention. I think we want all of the issues to be decided in the same place. Thanks for pointing that out. If my worry is this, it seems that if we take that sentence out, it seems like you're taking away most of the points that a citizen would want to make in challenging this issue. If all you allow them to do is challenge the enforceability of the contract and the constitutionality of the Stranded Gas Act, maybe you're not allowing them to challenge the real substantive questions that people have been talking about, like, is this gas stranded? For one reason or another reason, was the best interest finding impermissible? And any of the host of substantive issues that people normally challenge the Department of Natural Resources on. Is that concern valid?
Well, I think that was brought out here. This is really a jurisdictional question, and I don't see anything in the statute that was put together that would address that question, either yay or nay. It really is simply putting jurisdiction, and I don't see anything in here that precludes a party from raising any of those issues in a action that would be brought under this jurisdictional statute. That's not to say that anyone bringing that action would be able to get past a summary judgment or a motion to dismiss based upon the position that the administration has raised. But I don't see anything in this jurisdictional statute which would impact that, unless you specifically put a provision in here saying that, I think as I've heard one of the representatives mention, was in the other statute, another bill. But I don't see that here.
If somebody tried to delete that sentence, the right to challenge a final agency decision of the Commissioner of Revenue under 430C, and then said, and you can't appeal that issue, if that was their intention, to just take that out of the right to judicial review, though, then would you be prevented on appeal from being able to challenge things like whether the gas is stranded, whether it's in the best interests, and those things?
I'm not sure what the answer to that question would be. I do know, though, that the sentence that it, the clause that it's currently in, is not a preclusion from challenge clause. It's a statute of limitations clause.
Okay.
So without changing the language or adding different language, all this would do would be remove that one issue from the statute of limitations limitation.
And just finally, say, but I mean, I think you've answered this, but I'm being slow on this because I'm stuck on the point that I thought this bill addressed that now it seems it doesn't. If we adopt the amendment, which is essentially to adopt the Senate committee version of the bill with the extra sentence in it, and if we wanted to be sure that all of these issues were decided in the same court with the same time frame, then I guess the point would be to leave that sentence in.
That would appear to be the case.
Okay. Does anyone else have any further questions for Mr. Gilden?
No.
Okay.
So well, I'm like not sure, but we may as we go along.
Okay. Mr. Gilden, are you hourly?
yes, I am, Madam Chair.
That's what I thought. If it was a flat fee, it wouldn't be so bad. But I'd just like to really, we only have 15 more minutes anyway before floor session, so... So let's just continue then. Representative Wilson?
I was just going to ask him if he has the House bill at all.
Mr. Gilden, we know you had the Senate version. Do you have the House version of the bill as well?
Was that the same as the original Senate version?
That's correct.
Yes, I had that.
Yes, he does.
I would like to hear his opinion between the two.
Okay. Representative Wilson would like your opinion as between the original bill and the bill that was amended in the Senate.
Sure. One preface point is I would have no opinion as to the whether you use 60 days or 120 days. That, to me, again, is purely a policy decision on your part. But the rest of the amendment that was made in the committee substitute, I think is a improvement on what the original bill had been. There were some language difficulties that I found in the original Senate bill and I guess House bill that I thought that the committee substitute had improved on. So from my review, again, not talking about the time frame that was changed, I think the rest of the language is an improvement.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Gruenberg.
This is, I'm going to ask something that Mr. Baldwin alluded to a few minutes ago, and I'm going to ask Mr. Gilden what his thoughts are, as well as Mr. Baldwin. Let's start with Mr. Gilden. And that is the notwithstanding language, notwithstanding any other provisions of law, any other provision of law. It used to be, as a matter of drafting around here, Mr. Gilden, that we didn't use that kind of a phrase. And now drafters tend to do that. Mr. Baldwin seemed to have some thoughts on that phrase. I'd ask Mr. Gilden his thought on that phrase and then Mr. Baldwin.
Sure. The first comment I would have with respect to using that phrase would be a review of other legislative, other actually judicial decisions by the Supreme Court interpreting the legislature's actions in other cases as to whether or not how they deal with conflicts of law questions and which has supremacy. So without knowing that answer, I can't give you a definitive answer. Obviously, putting notwithstanding any other provision of law is the safer mechanism to make sure that you don't have to deal with that question of conflicts of law. But again, I think that's a drafting that if you have an intimate knowledge of how the Supreme Court interprets your conflicts of law cases, then you'd have a better call as to whether it's better in or is not necessary.
May I follow up, Madam
Yes.
Chair? Okay. For the people, for the members of the committee and even me, how does the notwithstanding clause relate to specifically conflicts of laws issues? If you're talking about that in the traditional sense, conflict of laws with other jurisdictions, or are you talking about conflict with other Alaska laws?
Conflict with other Alaska laws.
Okay, I understand.
And it's been adopted at different times.
Okay, and I'd ask Mr. Baldwin his thought on that phrase.
Well, Madam Chair, I think this is dealing with the provision in the Stranded Gas Act that declares it to be a final agency action when the preliminary or when the final finding is fine. So it's
that answers
I think
my
it's
question.
Negating that. I think that's the intent. That's my understand what the Senate was up to.
Now I'm going to ask Mr. Baldwin a question,
Representative,
and since it's sort of a question I'd like to have answered for the next time we meet. When you and I talked, Mr. Baldwin, and Mr. Gelden, if you're kind of listening on this too, Mr. Baldwin indicated to me that his thought was the term contract, as we're talking about all the way through, and I'm looking at the Coghill Amendment, is mentioned several times, the word contract, was referring to the contract here. And I would ask Mr. Baldwin, is that the administration's intent to refer solely to the contract?
Madam Chair, we're addressing here the fiscal contract. We're our obligation to our co-parties to this proposed agreement is to expeditiously resolve the, if you will, marquee constitutional and enforcement issues surrounding the stranded gas fiscal contract. That's what we're attending to address here.
Then if that's the case, I would ask Mr. Baldwin and Ms. Harris and Mr. Gelden, if necessary, to come up with some language that I can offer as an amendment to this, defining, quote, contract as that, the technical language. And I would plan to offer that next time we meet. Would you be willing to do that?
So we have the amendment in front of us. Is there further discussion? There was an objection from Representative Cott. There's been discussion. We had one amendment that was that carried deleting a reference to person. We have the amendment back before us. Is there further discussion on the amendment itself? Okay. Madam Secretary, Representative Wilson?
Well, I'm still hung up on the number of days, I guess.
And should the amendment pass, then you're free to offer an amendment the other way. Should the amendment fail, then people that want parts of the amendment in that were in it are free to offer. So we'll just see how the votes go. Madam Secretary, we call the roll on amendment number one.
Representative Anderson.
No.
Representative Wilson.
No.
Representative Coghill.
Yes.
Representative Grunberg.
Yes.
Representative Cott.
No.
Representative Garrett.
Yes.
Representative McGuire.
No.
Three yes, four no.
So amendment number one fails to carry. Are there further amendments to House Bill number 2002?
Yes, there are.
Okay. Representative Grunberg, tell us which.
Okay.
Is the amendment that says Bailey that has.
I don't have anything in writing.
Representative,
I suggest that we go ahead and recess to the call of the chair. I'm going to have to leave to get ready for the floor session,
okay.
And that will give him a chance to write up his amendment.
Okay. And that will give you a chance to regroup and think about which parts. Okay, so we'll recess to the call of the chair. We'll meet following the adjournment of floor session today.
Just for a moment.
And it'll be for the sole purposes. Public testimony is closed now, so it'll just be to continue working through these amendments. But it's my intent to go till we have to get this done today. Okay? So we'll recess to the call of the chair.
So the bill will be passed on.